regular water or water with a high mineral deposit?
Yeah, the sparkling water.
Well, but sparkling water is a different thing. Sparkling water, okay, so you mean carbonated water?
That's correct.
Okay, so he's asking out there whether you people think that the sparkling carbonated water would be easier or harder to swim through.
Swan.
Yes, Paul?
If it's got bubbles, it's going to be harder to swim through. You tend to sink a lot easier back your way.
I have a thought, WV3AD.
Okay, Ed?
It says, you know, when you're sitting somewhere too long, maybe some part of your body might, quote, fall asleep. And they say it feels like it's sitting in ginger ale. So the question is reminding me of that.
I'm going to add something to the question. Would the boat stay better afloat in the sparkling mineral water or in regular water?
Wait, are you swimming or boating?
Dr. Roy, rephrase it.
Well, I think the actual question that he was going to ask was about how boats can float under different circumstances. So for the sake of Wesley's question, consider him now in a boat rather than swimming.
Correct.
Can I ask a question? Why do we care? Is there enough sparkling water in the country to float a boat?
The question is very important because your gasoline prices may go over $5 tomorrow. And the next question would be what the sparkling water has to do with the gasoline price. But the first question, if somebody is able to give some ideas, enter a gym.
Matt, TCT Bill.
Yes?
I'm assuming it has to do with displaced tonnage. So it depends entirely on the density of the water. So if you'd enlighten us as to what the density of one in one case is and the density in the other cases, then someone can give you the answer.
Well, we know that we are dealing with water. One is sparkling water, carbonated water, and the other one is regular water. At which water the boat will stay afloat better?
I asked you a question. What's the density of the water in one case, and what's the density of the water in the other case?
Okay, in the first case, when we're dealing with regular water, then we take the same water and we carbonate the same water. And the question applies to the same water, but carbonated. Enter it here.
Water, basically water and a carbon dioxide form, what's called carbonic acid. So it's a dilute solution of carbonic acid, but it's unstable.
I quit.
Okay, Dr. Roy, what do you think?
I think personally, Wesley, you probably should have used the real life situation, because it seems to be upsetting everyone, because there are complications. When you introduce weirdness like sparkling ocean water, it has no correlation with reality. And as Ed mentioned, there is an equilibrium state between the dissolved carbon dioxide, the carbon dioxide bubbles, and carbonic acid in solution that complicates it. In reality, what you're really getting at is more natural gas eruptions from the bottom of the ocean, and the question being, is that good, bad, or indifferent for the ship traveling across the ocean that has methane eruption at the base of that area of the ocean. So I think if you keep it into the real world, there'll be less people who have problems dealing with the unnecessary other factors.
You're right. So let's say Bermuda Triangle, possible explanation, and then we have another something that happened a few days ago and is causing your gasoline price to go up. So the question is, do you, Dr. Roy, or anybody else is able to give an answer about the ship on the sea that enters the part of the water that is somehow saturated with gas?
Right. There is an issue in Northern Europe about natural gas, but you're talking about carbon dioxide.
Dr. Roy?
Yes. I think Wesley decided to change the parameters for some reason, but this is really a discussion of the natural gas coming off of the ocean and how it's affecting boats. That's kind of what the subject really is. I don't know why, but the names were changed to protect the non-innocent, I guess.
Who cares? The idea is not to blow the whole place up with natural gas.
VDH with a comment.
Yes, John?
Yeah, the solution of water and any dissolved gas in it is not a stable compound, so you really can't speak of a density. Like if Wesley's original statement about mineral water, I could say, okay, with dissolved salts and minerals in the water, you know, a person generally floats higher. Like if you go to Salt Lake, you'll float very high, or in the Dead Sea, you'll float very high because of the high mineral content. But in terms of a dissolved gas, I think that question is kind of hard to understand as far as the density of the water itself with the gas dissolved.
I see that we have a few minutes left, so I'm going to go for you. I was trying to make a puzzle for you guys. So the Denmark established a prohibited area to ensure ships do not go near the gas going from underground of the from bottom of the Baltic Sea. Ships may lose buoyancy, and there may be also risk for ignition above the water and in the air, that is said by the authorities. Then 27 members of EU foreign agency also did make the same or similar statements. And that is due to the event that happened at 27 of last month, and is affecting right now your gasoline price. Let me jump.
Question one, please. WS2N.
Go ahead.
So are you talking about the two pipelines that they blew up, the two methane lines, or they said the natural gas lines, actually?
That is correct. I'm talking about Northern Stream 1 and 2. Northern Stream 1 and 2 is going through the bottom of the Baltic Sea, and is going from Russia along the sea and is going to Germany. It's going a little bit around the Bornholm Island and is ending with Lubin in Germany. Now, what happened was that all of a sudden that pipeline that was raised with $3.5 billion and 12 months of construction, but that was only the undersea part, the part that was from the Siberia to the Baltic Sea was built for about 17 years.
My understanding is neither of those was actually carrying flow, although they were at pressure but static. I think it's self-correcting as the gas in the escapes, because there's no new gas coming in.
Well, I have a question because we have a little time. Maybe Dr. Roy, if you would apply to that saturated with gas water, the physical law, which one would you choose? The laws of thermodynamics, the Newton law, or Archimedes?
AC2GS. Well, this particular thing is complicated and in some engineering aspects fascinating. This is a complicated picture. Ordinarily, I would agree and look at this as a buoyancy issue. If you're decreasing the density of the fluid below the boat, you're decreasing the buoyancy of the boat. But in addition, there are other forces. One second. There are other forces that act. There's all the gas dragging up water around it and drag. So you have decreased buoyancy because the density is going lower, but you also have the drag introduced from the gas bubbles going up. And so it's a very complicated configuration. At the center of the disturbance, the buoyancy of the boat is probably not in danger. At the edges of the bubbles, though, is where the two forces don't equal out and where you can sink a boat. So modeling, I think, demonstrates that it's not right above the leak that's the most dangerous, but at the edges of where the leak is because of the opposing forces at play.
PhD comment.
Yes, Jim. Yes, Jim?
So I would believe that there's buoyancy issues. It's not my world that I lived and worked in, but there's a larger issue at stake when you're dealing with natural gas and ships and massive releases of natural gas, is that diesel engines, when they're in the presence of natural gas in their intake air, there's a phenomenon called diesel engine overspeed, where the engine will just run up to infinite RPMs until it explodes. It can't be stopped other than with, like, giant dampers that shut off the air intake, and they don't always work because the forces generated by a diesel engine overspeeding is massive. And I'm sure that ain't too good for a ship. So lots of interesting technology and involved with what's going on over there. Keep in mind that the bubbles are probably a square mile at most. The flammable gas field could be much bigger. Thank God natural gas is lighter than air, so it probably normally doesn't float at the surface, but weird things happen in the atmosphere. Just a couple thoughts from my background to add to the conversation. Back to Ned.
Okay, so the anybody completely or partially submerged in the fluid, gas, or liquid at rest is acted upon by an upward or buoyant force, and the magnitude of which is equal to the weight of the fluid displaced by the body. So Bermuda Triangle may actually be one of the examples of the disappearing ships. We're also dealing with a person swimming in the water. It would be much harder to keep afloat, and it requires more force from the person swimming in the water saturated with the gas than they would do the regular one. And also, we're dealing with planes. If the density of the air was lower, then that would require more force for the airplane to stay in that substance, not in the air, whatever. But anyhow, what happened. There were two pipelines of Northern Stream 2, which one was never put into the action because of the restriction blown, and one pipeline of Northern Stream 1. So it is only one operational Northern Stream 1, the very old one from 2005, if I remember correctly. and that one is not used because Russia decided before the war to stop delivery of the gas to Europe. Let me jump. So now, so then we had a spike of the prices of the gasoline, and our government was trying to do the best they could, releasing the reserves to make the price go down, and it was good till yesterday. The news were that OPEC decided to minimize the deliver the digging. I have no proper word. The pumping the oil from the earth, and now we have since today we have a news that the gasoline price is gonna go up again. So that's the story. Now, if there are any questions, I would appreciate. If not, I'm going to quickly go to the sabotage, another sabotage that happened yesterday of Kerch Bridge. And to Asia.
To me. Where's Paul?
Yesterday in the morning, 6:01 a.m. of Europe time, of Greenwich time, actually, the Kerch Bridge was blown. The Kerch Bridge was a structure of very important to Russia, and I'm trying to find the proper article. The Kerch Strait Bridge, I'm reading, connecting Russia to Crimea is extremely important both strategically and politically, stretching for more than 10 miles, is the longest bridge in Europe, and was constructed after Russia's illegal annexation of Ukraine and Crimea, and opened in 2018 at cost of $3 billion. Putin himself drove the truck across and opened it. It is a huge and obvious target for the Ukrainian strike, and now seems to be under the threat with the new doomsday clock supposed to counting down to the bridge construction. Let me jump. I sent to Dr. Roy, I don't know if he had... hold on. Okay, I sent to Dr. Roy, I know we had the time to view the videos of the bridge, how it's constructed, and the video of the two passes of the highway through the bridge, and there was a third one next to it, parallel to it, which is the railroad. Two flights between four piers were blown up completely. And there is a video saying, showing possible cause of it. They say that the truck was carrying explosive material, but at the same time, the truck was also shown in another video as inspected and allowed to cross. And there is a question how much of explosives is needed to damage such a structure. Doctor, did you see the videos?
Yeah, I saw the videos. It's still up in the air. No one's admitting to doing it. So there's no details. The usual reason, as you mentioned, is a truck packed with explosives. It might have benefited by some explosives that were on another track of that either in the trains or someplace else. There's talks about bots and drones and underwater devices. I think that the Ukrainians don't quite have those facilities. So my guess would be it was a fortuitous combination involving a truck full of explosives, but it's yet to be really understood. In time, hopefully, everyone will say what it really is. But right now, everyone's nudging, winking, and not saying much in the way of facts.
Okay, so there was a NATO article. I didn't send it to you. And also another article coming from, I'm trying to find it, Forbes. It says that the 8 tons of, 8 tons, metric tons of explosive could just make a dent on it. But we see that two flights between four piers were completely blown up and went to the water. So the question is, of course, Ukraine says we don't admit that we did it. And we go to the point who blew the pipelines in the Baltic Sea and who blew the Kerch bridge. We may assume that actually Putin by itself did it. The first was the pipeline was blown probably because exactly at the same very day there was an opening of the new pipeline between Poland and Norway for delivering gas to Europe. And now, because Russia accused United States of America and Europe to participate in it, they will seek the cause to blow that or any other pipelines, where if that happened, that would affect even more our gas prices that we're paying right now today. As far as the Kerch Bridge is involved, we may see that there is stronger and stronger the message sent by the Russian government about local nuclear weapon usage. It's a sort of the small nuclear weaponry that could be used just to cause somebody to give up. Because right now Russia is losing the war. I'm not trying to keep it political, but in the way it is affecting us, everybody of us, if anything of that happens. So if the price of the oil goes up, or if eventually the nuclear weaponry is being used. Enter a cheer.
Okay, Wesley, they're strategic nuclear weapons. They're low yield. Rather than megatons of TNT equivalency, they're kilotons. They're meant theoretically to drop on large collections of military, like a military fort, or where you have a lot of soldiers and you have a lot of military equipment, which Ukraine doesn't really have. So the only place they get anything out of it is if they bomb civilians and turn even the Indians and maybe even the Chinese against them. So I tend to think it's saber rattling.
Okay, the next subject I'm going to leave for the next week. If there are any questions, I would be happy to, or comments, I would be happy to hear. Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Ray.
And thank you, too, Wesley. And thanks to everyone who participated tonight. And now we bring you Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet Report.
Sounds like I got to start eating more iodized salt,
contact my thyroid here with all the nuke talk. I'd rather talk about the peaceful end of things, and that has to do with the space program. The double thyroid redirection test, which took place a couple of weeks ago. The DART mission, well, it was successful. They hit the asteroid. It was a binary asteroid. And since then, we've been taking telescopes on Earth and looking at the past. It takes 12 hours for the small asteroid to go around the larger one. And it's aligned with the ecliptic, so they could tell whether or not it gets brighter or dark, you know, or in the exact second that, you know, that it used to pass in front of the asteroid and then move past it. Now, if that's changed, then they know it will work. So it looks like we're going to find out this Tuesday. Couple days from now, at 2 p.m., NASA is going to have a news conference on how the DART mission is faring. We'll see. I'll report on that next week. Or if you go to the NASA site, I'm sure they'll tell you on Tuesday. So they'll actually have a live or sometimes the teleconferences. I think this one's going to be televised. Let me drop it.
WB2EAB.
Hi, Ed. Back to you.
Yeah, I've been listening to all of the talk about it, and I've given it some thought. And I think a lot of people don't understand. They picked the asteroid pair. Yeah, it's very, very, very easy to observe, it's very well understood, they know just about everything they need to know. And I believe, long before they ever launched DART, they were able to predict what the mass and velocity of the rocket hitting the smaller asteroid would do to its orbit. And I think the whole thing is just to prove whether or not our understanding of this inter-asteroid kinetics is correct by trying it, and if it matches the theoretical predictions, they'll say, yeah, we understand. If it doesn't, they have to figure out why not.
I agree. I know they have the computer models all test this out. You know, they knew if the DART spacecraft was a little over 1,000 pounds, traveling at just under 14,000 miles an hour, and you hit a small asteroid weighing a certain amount of kilograms, traveling at a certain speed, as long as they hit a dead center, they would know how much it's going to slow down. If they hit it off center, then of course I guess the numbers would have been different. So their goal was to see their accuracy. They had special cameras looking at the two asteroids. As it was coming closer, you know, it would pick up two of them at one time, and they figured out that, you know, the one that with less light was the smaller one, and it directed itself heading that way. It was all autonomous, you know, we had nothing to do with it. It's all programmed to do it by itself. In fact, they ran a test a couple of days before, they had the same cameras look at Jupiter. And one of the Galileo moons, I don't know if it was Europa or, one of those moons, and they looked at the two to see if the camera, the brains attached to the thing was smart enough to look at the proper the proper light, not Jupiter, but the moon itself, and that worked out good. So they were pretty convinced that once they got close to this double asteroid, things were going to go well. So yeah, I agree with you, Ed. I'm sure it's all done on, you know, they probably know exactly to the second or to the microsecond of how much it's going to slow down going around that asteroid. But what's not really talked about much is the idea is to move both asteroids. And by changing the time of the smaller asteroid around the larger asteroid, that changes pull on the, on the larger asteroid just slightly. You combine all the different gravitational effects, and they believe it's going to move, a certain part of a degree one way or another. Both of them will actually move. And that's the goal, not just to slow one down just to see if they get hit. They actually want, by changing the orbit, you're actually going to change the direction of both asteroids. And if you do it early enough, the earlier you find this, and, it is on a direct, on a direct course to Earth, if you find it early enough, you don't have to change it much of a degree to have it miss Earth. Back to you, Ed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, I have to tell you, one thought that occurred to me, I think we're in total agreement on that. They knew what it should do, and this is to say, all right, does it really do that? But one thought I had is you could say, isn't this a form of vandalism or littering? And the answer to that is take a look at the moon. And you realize just how many times anything in space gets hit by all kinds of stuff flying through.
Oh, yeah, I know. But you're saying that all the stuff that hits the moon is actually slightly changing. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm just saying I had a thought. Aren't we kind of like polluting an alien body? But then I realized it's probably pretty well pre-polluted by all of the various meteorites and other space junk that's always hitting everything.
Move on.
Yeah, you remember all the awful missions around the moon. Well, after that, they started it with Ranger, and Ranger missions would crash into the moon, and after that, of course, you have the Russians. They're basically doing the same thing, crashing stuff. Top part of the lens, the ascent modules of all the, not all lens, but it looks like four of them crashed onto the moon. One went into heliocentric orbit. The other one they feel is the original. They feel is still actually orbiting the moon. Well, Apollo 11 anyway. So, and then all the other space junk. We've tested things crashing into the moon, and then taking pictures of it. You had one thing crash into the moon, and then there was a booster behind it taking pictures. And they wanted to see if water, would vaporize and leave the moon's surface. Probably hundreds of things that have already crashed on the moon. I heard another station, somebody wanted to say something. WS2N, name here is Paul. Okay, nothing hurt. But what I was going to say is, every time the moon actually gets hit with something, it's actually going to actually change the speed of the moon ever so slightly. When you go and you use a planet for a gravity assist, you have the Voyagers and the Pioneers, they all use their, Jupiter for a gravity assist. It speeds up the spacecraft, and the planet itself actually slows down a touch, and they know mathematically the speed of Jupiter going around the sun will actually slow down some of a trillionth of a some ridiculous number of a second. But, you know, it's all, they could calculate that, and they have done that. So, I mean, they know all that works. I think they just wanted to test, like you said, the capability of actually being able to do it, hitting the asteroid dead center, you know, something moving, you know, at that speed relative to one another at 14,000 miles an hour. Let me move on to another topic unless somebody else has a comment.
KD2VHT, question/comment.
Oh, okay. VHT.
So I was wondering if Ed could just tell me if I'm wrong, if I paraphrase what he said, that we should not trust the science, but test the science to see if it actually holds true in the real world. Would I be accurate with that interpretation of what you said, Ed?
Absolutely. But let me be snarky and difficult here. What are you speaking of real world? This has nothing to do with the world. This is out near Jupiter.
Good point. Well taken. Touche, and I think we both made our point. Thank you.
Yeah, but you understood my point, Paul.
Absolutely.
Okay. In the case of Dart, anyway, it's 7 million miles away when they tried this experiment. But, you know, give it time. We'll cover these planets and moons with Coke cans after a while. I saw a documentary where they showed a ship going down near South America somewhere, and there's cans, you know, cans floating around in the ocean out in the middle of nowhere. What are you going to do? They need a worldwide conservation, I guess. I just want to talk about the Dragon crew vehicle that went up, CRS number 5, the fifth regular crew mission to the International Space Station with 4 people on board. That went up last Wednesday and successfully launched from Launch Complex 39A and eventually docked with the International Space Station. On board they had a cosmonaut, Anna Kegnia. She's the only female cosmonaut with Russia right now. She got to go for a ride on the Dragon spacecraft. The commander was Nicole Mann. She a Marine colonel from, you know, she's the flyer, the F-18s and all of that years ago, but she's been trying to get to space for 10 years, just like the Russian lady. And they finally got their first statement. She was the commander of this. She was originally supposed to go up on the Starliner being built by Boeing and Lockheed, the United Launch Alliance. But that mission has been delayed many, many times. Should have gone up a couple of years ago. And eventually Starliner will probably go up this February. But they didn't know that about a year or so ago, so they reassigned Nicole Mann to the Dragonflight as the commander. And then there was two other guys that went up, an American astronaut from NASA and another one from JAXA from the Japan Space Agency. He was the only one. He's been up like 4 different times. The other three never went up to space before. Anyway, they docked and successfully docked with the Harmony module, and they'll spend another almost 6 months docked to the space station. The other crew of four will be coming back next week. That's the way they usually do it. Whoever's going to be coming down, they'll send a crew up, and then usually a week or two later, the other crew comes back down. So temporarily, anyway, you have 11 people on the International Space Station right now, and actually a total of 14 people in space if you include the three taconauts, they're called, the Chinese astronauts that are on their space station. So, I mean, it's not a record, but it's close to it. 14 people, 14 humans flying in orbit at this time. Any comments before I move on? Yeah, so, anyway, SpaceX is still doing these flights. Looking forward to having another vehicle. I don't like the idea of having one vehicle. NASA has always had redundancy. I'm a big fan of that as well. And as soon as probably this February, we'll have another vehicle starting to send crews up called Starliner, like I said before, by Boeing, but launched on a United Launch Alliance, which is a combination of Boeing and Lockheed rocket on the Atlas V rocket, which has never taken a human up into space yet. It's been human rated, but it's never flown anybody yet. But that should be pretty exciting. It's a bigger vehicle inside. You know, it's got more square feet. It's a little wider in diameter. So looking forward to that. All right, let me move on to this other test thing that they've got to sell. They call it LOPID. LOPID is a heat shield that they're testing. They have a long name for it. Low Earth Orbit Flight Test of an Inflatable Decelerator. They put the letters together and you wind up with LOPID or LOPID. It's an inflatable heat shield. I've talked about it before on the net. But November 1st, a couple of weeks from now, they will launch it out of Vandenberg Air Force Base. It's going to be actually teamed up with another satellite. They'll launch it I believe it's an Atlas V. They'll release the satellite, but this thing will now officially be in orbit. They've tested it before on a suborbital flight to see if it works. A different version of the LOPID, which worked okay. But now this will be the first time they'll actually have something trying to slow down from 17,500 miles an hour. Come flying through the atmosphere. It's got a big gas tank or nitrogen tank on the back that's going to inflate all these rings of these tubes. It'll be small. It'll be a very small package to be able to fit inside the fairing of the rocket. But once it's in space, it'll inflate and it'll turn into this 20-foot diameter thing, which is bigger than any of the present heat shields that we have. I think Starliner is going to be like 15 and a half feet. Dragon is around 12 and a half feet. Space Launch System, Orion, I believe that's around 16 feet. And this thing will be 20 feet, which, it doesn't sound like it's that much bigger, but for every foot you gain in diameter, you're gaining a lot more square footage, and square footage, when it comes down to being able to slow something down, it's a lot. So it'll cut through the atmosphere, get down to around 300 miles an hour, and it does have its own parachute system. And they will recover it and examine it. But they say that this thing is going to be able to withstand just as much heat as a regular heat shield. Now, once they develop this, I have a picture here. I should have sent it to Dr. Roy's website. I have a picture of it with this worker standing below it. Gives you an idea of what this thing would look like. And anyway, once they have this thing qualified for use, they'll be able to use it to send large payloads to Mars. I know I've talked about this before, and that they're going to require 6,000 pound things to land on Mars. The biggest thing that we can land on Mars without parachutes is just 1 ton. You know, the Curiosity and Perseverance weigh just over 2,000. Well, one weighs 2,200 pounds. The other one's around 2,000 pounds. So 1 ton items. But after that, we don't have the capability of landing something heavier than that. So we need to have a much bigger heat shield, and you'll be able to take, you know, maybe 2 tons or 3 tons, you know, whatever it takes. And they're going to need that for, you know, habitats. They're going to need that for large oxygen making equipment. We'll see. The other good purpose for it, let's say you needed to bring something back very large from the International Space Station. I can't think of anything right now that they would need to do, but, you know, in time you might need that, or maybe even with one of the new space stations that are going to be going up, such as the Orbital Reef. Orbital Reef is going to be built by Sierra Nevada, and they're partnered up with Blue Origin to build this, you know, massive space station around Earth. And when they're done, it's supposed to have the equivalent or more cubic feet of space on the inside that we now have on the International Space Station. In the International Space Station, you have like 15 modules that attach to one another. So it's like, you know, living in a five-room house, so like 15 rooms anyway. This lofted thing could actually bring back things to Earth that they can't do now. Right now, the only thing that we can bring back is maybe 3,000-4,000 pounds of stuff, but not large stuff, compressed stuff on the Dragon spacecraft. They send the cargo vehicles up as well as the crew vehicles. The crew vehicle just went up. I talked about one. They still send cargo vehicles up. The other cargo vehicles don't bring anything back. We have Cygnus that goes up. That's a cargo vehicle that's launched by Northrop Grumman now. And you have Japan is planning on eventually sending more cargo vehicles up as well. They've sent 9 of them up over the years. And they're working on a new version of their cargo vehicles. Also, they're working on a new rocket, too. They upgraded their rocket system. Any comments? This is WS2N. Time for Echolink. India has now lost contact with its Mars spacecraft. They put one up in orbit 2014. It was launched in 2013, and it was called the Mars Orbital Mission. They nicknamed it MOMS. Now, after all these years, they have finally lost contact with it. It's still in orbit around Mars, but they think the fuel ran out. It could go into shade for a while during an eclipse. Batteries were getting low anyway. There's only a certain amount of charge and recharge that they could take. And they tried to reestablish communications with it, and they haven't done it. But they're moving along with their space program. They actually have a human space flight program going. And the first flight of that is supposed to take place, they're predicting next year. So they're supposedly getting ready to do that. They have their own launch vehicles. They have two main launch vehicles that they use. One they use for geosynchronous launches, and another one they use for a smaller one that they use for the polar launches. And the geosynchronous launch vehicle will be used for manned space flight. Well, we'll see how they do, but they're moving along. I mean, they launch rockets not as often as we do. They have contracts for communication constellation systems. Similar to what SpaceX is doing with Starlink. They have a contract with OneWeb. OneWeb is trying to put up 600 satellites for their system. So they're moving right along. There was another launch that I paid attention to last week, too. The Electron rocket went up, launched from New Zealand. And that's actually an American company, Rocket Lab, builds the Electron rocket. And they successfully launched a couple of satellites. Well, this one's a 250-pound satellite into orbit. And it's one of these satellites that have extremely sensitive receivers on board. There's a lot of animals throughout the world that have been tagged, by scientists. They could be whales or birds or whatever they are, and they have little transmitters on board. These satellites, the Electron has put into space by Rocket Lab, has the capability of picking up these signals. So it's a better system than what they had in the past. Much more sensitive. They'll be able to keep better track of all the migration of the animals. But they're paying Rocket Lab to do this. Everybody doesn't jump on the SpaceX bandwagon. They go with these other companies as well. There's, two more of them coming online. Last week I talked about Firefly. They got their first successful orbital flight last a week or two ago, and they plan on six more rockets for next year, and then of course more after that. And they actually have another larger version rocket that they're working on. So apparently they have worldwide enough launches to fill up all these companies' manifest. They were actually backlogged, which I would have never guessed at the beginning when all these companies were starting up. But they're going strong. Any comments? WS2N. Okay, the Capstone spacecraft also was launched by Rocket Lab on an Electron rocket. Goal of capstone is to get it into a heliocentric orbit of the moon, which means an orbit roughly about 40,000 miles out by maybe 2,000 or 3,000 miles to the closest point of the moon. So it's going to be a highly elliptical orbit. It would take about 11 days to actually orbit the moon. And the idea of this is by NASA. NASA paid Rocket Lab to launch this thing, is to actually test out the viability of that orbit. This goes back to what Ed was talking about. You know, they've done the math. They know that this thing should work. It should wind up in that particular orbit. But, you know, when push comes to shove, they need to show that they can actually do it. And that's what this is. And the reason they need to get this into that particular orbit is in the near future, we're going to be launching the Gateway space station. And the Gateway space station will be put into that exact orbit. So, you know, you'll have a crew of, you know, 3-4 people maybe on a permanent basis on that space station orbiting the moon every 11 days. And once that's in place, you know, you could have eventually the Space Launch System launching an Orion spacecraft, eventually docking with the Gateway space station. And from there, you have a human landing vehicle. Right now, they've chosen SpaceX for this, but I think I just mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. NASA has now put a contract out for other companies that are willing to duplicate what SpaceX is doing, building their own vehicles, and you know, showing NASA what they have, and then NASA will probably pick at least one other company. Again, you'll have redundancy, which is very important. You don't
that
just
time complete
with a landing vehicle that's going to go down to the moon and come back up and rely on that 100%. If something happens, you want to be able to save the other people that are down there, and you need another vehicle completely different than whatever SpaceX has at the time, because something might be wrong with that vehicle, it might also be wrong with the new one. Send a completely different vehicle down there. And vice versa, the other vehicle that will be sending crews to and from the moon could also get stuck down there as well, and SpaceX could save the day. That's pretty much all I have for now. Any comments for the SpaceNet report? This is WS2N.
KD2BHD, short question.
Okay, KD2BHD. Very good. Back to you.
So the concept of having a completely different secondary vehicle sounds good to me, you know. But what if a failure is caused by a known rather than an unknown reason, and a simple fix is available on an alternate same vehicle? You have anything to comment on that thought? Because it's interesting, the idea of a dual redundant system, which is commonly used in military aircraft, and having a alternate. So a lot of different conflicting ideas. Any thoughts to share, and I'll leave it back to you.
Yeah, I'm not really sure of the your comment, your question. You know, two completely different vehicles. But now, what are you saying? Redundancy among each vehicle? Is that what you're saying? In other words, two different rocket systems. If one fails, they have another way to get off the moon.
You were mentioning that they would have a completely different option, a different vehicle, different manufacturer, and that there's definitely merit to that. But you also, if you have a failure and you know what the failure mode is, you can fix it on the secondary vehicle of the same sort. Having a totally different vehicle complicates the thing. I don't know that you'll have an answer right now, but it's just a concept I wanted to throw out there, having had some old experience in military avionics.
WD2EAV.
Good point. Well, they're going to have multiple ports eventually on the space station on Gateway, so at least two.